Baie dankie dat julle gekom het vir hierdie bespreking van Harry Kalmer se drama The Bram Fischer Waltz, wat ook in Afrikaans geskryf is as die Bram Fischer Waltz. Dis regtig 'n voorreg om my twee mede-aanbieders hierso aan u voor te stel. Naaste aan my is die dramaturg Harry Kalmer, 'n man wat sy woord goed kan doen, so ek sien eintlik baie uit na sy vertellings. En dan 'n werklik groot voorreg om ook hier te verwelkom meneer Dennis Goldberg, wat een van die manne was, trouwens die enigste wit Umkhonto we Sizwe lid wat in aanhouding geneem is tydens die Rivonia klopjag van 1963, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Goldberg, en hy het op die ou en 20 jaar uitgedien, waarvan dan 11, would it be 11, with Bram Fischer?
More or less right.
More or less right.
Give me a bit of a discount here and there, but it's okay.
Wonderful. En dis met ander woorde werklik waar 'n groot voorreg vir my om hier te sit, is eintlik 'n bietjie van 'n gelukkie vir my om te gevra gewees het om hiernatoe te kom. Ek dink ons kan lekker gesels oor sowel die drama as oor die lewe in die kommunistiese party, wat soos wat ons weet in 1950 verban is deur die destydse nasionale party regering. Bram Fischer, om die geskiedenis net 'n bietjie op te haal, is uiteindelik veroordeel tot lewenslange tronkstraf en hy het dit uitgedien anders as Shabir Shaikh tot enkele maande voor sy dood en hy is op die ouend oorlede in 1975. Daar so sy laaste paar dae in die noordelike voorstede van Bloemfontein deurgebring en die mense wat ek ken in daai Waverley gebied van Bloemfontein sê die huis het heeltemal 'n toeriste attraksie geword in daai laaste paar weke wat Bram Fischer daar was. Mense mag natuurlik nie met hom gepraat het nie, maar hulle kon verbyry en daarom sien hoe lyk die boerseun wat dan nou die pad van die kommunisme bewandel het. Harry, as ek by jou kan beginne, jy het die eerste keer van Bram Fischer bewus geword toe jy 'n jong seun was.
Ja, ja, ek kan onthou toe hy gevang is, 65. Wat my natuurlik gefascineer het, was sy vermoëns, wat oor die staar uitgepak was, jy weet. Ja, dit was my eerste bewuswording van hom.
En het jy gedink hy's 'n bose man, met die dat hy so rooi was?
Ek weet nie, ek het nie so daarna gedink nie, ek dink ek het na hom gekyk as 'n tipe van Scarlet Pimpernel. En soos het mens groot geword het, het jy eventually besef, he's one of the good guys. Jy weet, baie vroeg in my lewe het ek besef, okay, ja, daar is iets aan die gang. Maar wat ek moet erken, dat Bram so goed uit die geskiedenis uitgeskryf was, dat ek skaars kan sy dood kan onthou in 75. Ek kan dit letterlik skaars onthou. So dit wys hoe effektief die propaganda projek was.
Al ons sit hier so met 'n voormalige redakteur van die Burger hier so in die gehoor sien ek en die Burger het daarom 'n groot hoogtepunt gehad in daardie met die afsterwe van Bram Fischer toe Pietselje op 'n werklik verstommende manier aan hom hulde gebring het. Hy het gesê dat as jy iemand van die statuur uit jou volksfees verloor, dan moet jy jouself sekere vrae afvra. Mr. Goldberg, when did you first hear of Bram Fischer?
I'd like to answer your question, but I've got something to say before
that. Go for it.
First, thanks for allowing me to speak English at Voortfees. It shows that Stellenbosch is at last opening up to the world. And that's very nice to see in a country where we're enjoined by our constitution to create a cohesive, inclusive society. So it's very nice. It's also very nice for Stellenbosch University to have honored Bram Fischer amidst great controversy. Such controversy that the young woman who is here tonight, Yvonne Milan, who proposed Bram's honorary posthumous doctorate, got beaten up and severely wounded and injured by right-wing Afrikaner students. Wendy Berger was shocked that Stellenbosch University should honor this Volksverreier. I can't speak Afrikaans.
Yes, and you may if you wish.
And so things change, and change slowly. History takes day by day. I wish it was faster and quicker. But Bram Fischer isn't honored enough in the world. I don't know of any place named after him except Bloemfontein Airport, the Bromfisher Airport, because that was his hometown. And it's a deserved honor for a man who gave his life for our new South Africa. A man whom Nelson Mandela, no less, says showed him that not all Afrikaners are anti-black racists. Great achievement. I think Nelson Mandela should have understood that anyway. But you need positive examples always. I must say it's also nice to have Brahms' daughter Ruth here and her husband to be at this event and to see Stellenbosch opening up like this. I think it's important in our current situation where examples of racism that Brahms abhorred that should be taking place here, and that's the starting point. There's something else about Bromfisher. Everybody in government and the security police knew that Bromfisher was chairman of the illegal Communist Party, so much so that Dr. Verwoerd, in looking for a way forward for the folk, invited Brahm to his office to have a discussion about communism. Was this a policy for the Afrikaner folk? And he found this very interesting, did Dr. Verwoerd. Maar nie vir Afrikaner folk nie.
Liewer vir die ander mense.
And so there's Brahm defending us in the Rivonia trial when he's one of us. And there are documents bearing his handwriting being presented in the court. And him saying to us he felt safe from arrest while he was defending us during the trial, because the apartheid government had to show the world, meaning United States, Britain, France, Germany, that we were democratic and could have a fair trial. In a trial where the law did away with the concept of innocent until proven guilty, the Sabotage Act under which we were charged said, if there's a case against you, you have to prove your innocence. Well, you remember when you stole cookies from the pantry, how impossible it was because the crumbs were all over you. So, nevertheless, Brahm defended us. And weeks after the end of the trial, he was arrested, as you know. These are remarkable acts of courage and determination. So much so that during the trial, he took me aside one day to ask me what I thought of our situation. And we all expected to be hanged. There was no question that was what the state wanted, the prosecution and security police. And I didn't think it worth answering that question, because justice is about politics in the end. There's no absolute in law and decisions that are made by courts. Ministers overthrow them in the past and now. And I said I thought apartheid was living on borrowed time. And Brahm, who had a golden tongue in English and Afrikaans, it was a delight to hear him speak. He never swore in those days. Hey, man, you should have heard him afterwards when he was a prisoner. Did I learn my swearing vocabulary from him? That was remarkable. What a change. But in those days, he never swore. And I said, apartheid's living on borrowed time. And he said, we'll get the bastards, won't we? And it was such a powerful statement. His absolute iron backbone and his belief of what the future had to be. Now I can answer your question.
Good. I wanted to know, when first did you become aware of Bromfisher and in what way?
One was always aware that there was this guy, Bromfisher. But I lived in Cape Town and he in Joburg. And eventually I met him. And I met him because I knew his daughter Ruth through political activity when she was a student in Cape Town, as was her sister, knew them both. And Ruth, knowing I was in Johannesburg, invited me to Sunday lunch. And what was remarkable about it was that people just sort of dropped in, all his friends and comrades, and he's kind of sparkled. Whatever topic there was, he was asked his opinion, and his beloved wife and comrade Molly would sort of float in and out with trays of food and drinks and what have you, keeping the whole thing going. And Brian was very polite to me. He had just been handling a case of road construction, and me being a civil engineer, he was asking me questions about it, and he knew more of the theory of road building than I did. It was embarrassing, honestly. He told me it's a quick study that lawyers learn, you know, whatever case you're in, you learn it. But what struck me was that with 10 or 15 people, maybe more, floating in and out, and then some staying for lunch and some not, he was the center of attention. And he sparkled. That's when I really got to know him. And of course, in prison for 9 years, not 11, you get to know each other intimately, better than you know your spouse and your family, because you're together 24 hours a day. 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and damn it, they're leap years when there's an extra day.
Harry, toe jy besluit het om hierdie verstommende levensverhaal om te sit in 'n drama, hoe het jy te werk gegaan om het 'n dramatiese tekst te maak, wat ek gehoor en oudsoor, en toe ek dit bygewoon het, in die dorp van die Boerehaat verkiesing van 1972, staande ovasie te laat gee. Hoe maak jy wat inherent in 'n sekere sin 'n monoloog is van 'n stuk geskiedenis in 'n drama stuk in?
Ek dink dit was alles daar gewees. So ek het nie vreeslik baie werk gedoen nie. Dit is vir my interessant dat jy daai aand noem, want daai aand was daar 'n klomp komrades van die van die township gewees in die gehoor. En het is bykie soos om terug in die 80s te wees, in die meetings in die 80s, wat iemand sê iets, en dan sê iemand, ja, ja, boa, boa, soos ons in die noorde sê. En dit was, daai aand, in Oudtshoorn, het die kamerheids, hulle was ouwe mens, hulle was my ouderdom, en al daar gesit, en hulle het gesê, yes, en dit was een van die laaste vertoonings, wat ons in Afrikaans gedoen het. En dit was vir my, soort van, tekenend van die hele proces van Brahms se story vertel. Die story was daar, ek moes hom net gryp. Ek wil ook graag iets deel met julle. Ek het met 3 mense gepraat wat vir Brahms geken het. Ek het begin met Jeroen. En jy het vir my gesê, you must ask Ilse, you must ask Ilse. And then it said, no, Dennis would remember that, Dennis would remember that. And Jou het baie goed gegaan, want Jou is ook 'n skrywer, hy is ook 'n joernalis, en ek het ingegaan met vrae, en toe is ek so vol confidence, dat ek Ilse gebel het, en toe was ek glad nie voorbereid nie, en Ilse het gesien, ek struggle, en sy het begin praat, en baie van die goeders, onder andere die story van Brahms wat so sleg dans, is goeders wat ek daai middag by Ilse gekry het. En toe het my uitgewer my af Kaap toe gevlieg vir 'n funksie. En toe besef ek, dis 'n geleentheid vir my hierso om met Roos te praat en met Dennis te praat. En ek kon nie Roos in die hande kry, maar ek het Dennis in die hande gekry en ek het vir hom gaan kuier aan sy huis staan, houtpaai wat so uitkyk oor die see. And I walked into this raconteur, this man who was... Hy sê die myn van inligting oor Brahm en liefde vir Brahm en dat iets daai maar gebeur wat met Roos gebeur het, wat met Hugh gebeur het. Op 'n stadium, wanneer hulle oor Brahm gepraat het, het hulle in Afrikaans begin praat. En dit was vir my so 'n tekeningende oomblik gewees. Jy weet, want voordat ek met die projek begin het, het ek geglo Brahm is vir Engels. Meeste mense in Joburg is vir Engels. En Brahms was nie vir Engels nie. Brahms was deur en deur 'n boer. En dit het vir my Dit is vir my 'n belangrike ding wat ek besef het. In hierdie gesprekke met mense wat hom goed geken het, was hierdie oomblik dat hierdie man, hierdie mense wat so articulate in Engels was, dat hulle op 'n stadium net spontaan begin Afrikaans praat het. En dit sê vir my so baie. En dit is ook, ek wil graag met julle deel, uit die toneelstuk. Mense vra vir my altyd, hoekom het ek hierdie play geskryf? En ek het Mary Benson's The Sun Will Rise Again in die 80's in Londen te lees gekry. En ek het op die tube gesit en ek het gelees en ek het gehuil. Maar ek het daarvan vergeet. Ek het teruggekom Suid-Afrika toe en probeer om die play te vertel terwyl die ANC en die SHKP nou verban was. Dit het nie gebeur nie. Barney Simon, wat by die mark was op die stadium, het homself doodgelag toe ons kom met die proposal, want hy was probably one of the people who drove Mary around meeting Bram. So dit was die type goeikies. En toe jare later, toe ek die stuk skryf, toe vertaal ek wat ek nou vir julle gaan lees, en dis Bram se betoog met sy vonnis. En dis snaaks, ek het dit eers opgetel toe ek het terugvertaal Engels toe, en ek wil graag met julle deel wat vir my die quintessentie van Bram se quest, se journey, se geloof en alles was. En wat vir my belangrik is in hierdie ding is 'n ding wat Hugh Lewin vir my right up front gesê het: don't think you can talk about Bram without talking about Bram the communist. Jy weet, jy moet ook nie probeer om 'n soort van 'n super-Afrikaner te maak nie. Bram was 'n Marxist tot en met sy dood. En dit was 'n baie belangrike noot vir my gewees. En ek het probeer om dit te respekteer. Alhoewel die Marxisme vir my heeltemal 'n teoretiese veld was. Maar ek wil graag met julle deel wat Bram gesê het in sy vonnis. Hy het dit in Engels gesê. En ek het dit bietjie dramatiseer, want David en ek het hierdie found both in the English and Afrikaans, we found these rhythms of our parents' generation. The way David spoke, the way he articulated was based on people Bram's age, or maybe a little bit younger, people who would be turning 100 now. So we found this, and this was one of the keys. And my gedagtes, ek moet my gedagtes 25 jaar laat teruggaan om precies vast te stel wat my motivering was om by die communistische partij aan te sluit. In my gedagtes staan daar twee redes uit vir my betrokkenheid by die communistische partij. Die een is die skreiende sociale ongeregtigheid in ons land. Die ander is die geleidelike besef, soos ek meer en meer by die Kongresbeweging betrokken geraak het, dat het altyd die lede van die communistische partij was wat bereid was om die meeste op te offer, hulle beste te gee in die stryd teen diskriminasie en armoede. Ek glo dat Suid-Afrika is op pad na 'n burgeroorlog, en dat so 'n oorlog nooit deur wit mense gewen kan word nie. Maar wen of verloor hierdie edele, die gevolge vir hierdie land sal verpletterend en blywend wees. Daar is 'n verdere verpligting op my skouers, edele. My optrede beteken dat minstens een Afrikaner aktief protesteer. Ek is ernstig bekommerd oor 'n toekoms waar die Afrikaner die skuld gegee gaan word vir al die ewels en vernedering wat apartheid veroorsaak het. Dit voorspel niks goed nie. Dit het onder alle nie-blankes 'n diepliggende haat vir Afrikaners, ons taal en ons politieke en rasse uitkyk veroorsaak. Om hierdie muur af te breek sal groot wysheid, leierskap en invloed verg van Nelson Mandela en die ander leiers wat tans weens hulle politieke oortuigings in die tronk sit. Dit vereis ook dat Afrikaners openlik en duidelik teen diskriminasies moet protesteer. So, vir my was dit, en dit het ek eers besef toe ek die toneelstuk klaar geskryf het, dit was hoekom ek die storie wou vertel. Ek wou die storie vertel van Bram die mens, want dit was fascinating vir my gewees. Maar daar was die storie van Bram die communist, en daar was die storie van Bram die Afrikaner. En dit was die drie stories wat ek probeer vertel het.
Mr. Goldberg, you said you had quite an emotional reaction to the play, and then you told me a lovely story about Bram the gardener.
Well, you asked how did Harry take this story and turn it into a play, a dramatic piece. Well, in preparation for this, the organizer sent me a copy of the play in English, published by Wits University Press. I read the first page. I couldn't read further. You captured Brahm so accurately. It was like I was with him in prison. And that's very powerful. I don't know how you do it. If I did, I'd be the playwright, you see. I just write heavy prose. But you asked about Brahm the Afrikaner. One day in prison, walking with Brahm, we spent a lot of time talking. He said, Dennis, wat zal ons met my arme volk maak? And I said, what do you mean? He said, man, can't we give them a little piece of the Kalahari or something and let them do whatever they want to do so we can solve this problem quickly and get over with it? And I said, Brahm, they think they're the chosen race. They'll drill for water and find oil and we'll be dependent on them. The point is not my humor. The point is Brahm concerned about my arme volk. And what's the future if we go on as with this intensification of the occupation of the townships and so on? Then somehow at a time when no newspapers were allowed for 16 years, we were cut off from the world, or they tried to. A little piece of newspaper blew into the yard one day, which means some black prisoner, knowing we weren't getting newspapers, dumped something in our refuse bin and we put in tobacco, you know, so it blew into the yard somehow. And there was a poem, I think, of Einke Krogs. And Brahm was so proud that a young woman of his people could write such poetry with such deep understanding. I'm reinforcing your point of Brahm the Afrikaner. There was never any doubt about it. But the essence of Brahm's life was this conflict between his duty as an officer of the court to uphold the laws of the land and his moral duty to oppose what those laws were making of our society. And having had the privilege of studying politics and a bit of philosophy in prison for year after year after year, I've come to the conclusion that the way one resolves moral conflicts between what is in reality and what ought to be morally right is through action. And that's what Brahm the revolutionary did in so many ways. And there's the conflict in his life, which he refers to in that speech to the court, to the before sentence. There is a higher law of humanity, of decency, of justice, that you have to follow if you have conscience as a human being. I think it's important to understand that conflict. If you're on his side, that's heroic. If you're not on his side, you say he's a traitor. This is another aspect of bias and prejudice. And how Brahm, he describes in that speech how he plays with the kids on the farm, the black kids on the farm, and then as a student, grown up now, required to shake hands, he finds it difficult and realizes it's not the kids who've changed, it's he who's changed. And deals with them the only way he can, as if, dare I say it, he was a gentleman. He had respect for people. He was loved. I don't know of anybody in our movement who didn't hold him in the highest regard and still does to this day. And Harry, you captured this. You captured this. You captured the sensitive person who was tough as steel as well. Such a contradiction in the man.
En Harry, op 'n manier doen jy dit ook deur musiek, nee, dit kom nie net uit die titel nie, maar daar's vooral drie van die musiekstukke wat baie belangrik is in die stuk.
Ja, dis iets wat ek gesteel het by wat Ilse my vertel het, is dat op die begrafnis in Bloemfontein of op die verrassing of die bijeenkomst, toe speel hulle boereplaas en die veiligheidspolisie was heel tyd comfortable om mee, maar dit was natuurlijk ook the red flag. En had een baie interessante ding met my gebeur. Ja, en Tannebel, maar ek wil nie dit rek nie. Maar had een baie interessante ding met my gebeur, toe ons Bram Fischer hier in Bloemfontein gedoen het, ach, hier in Stellenbosch. In 2012, of 2013, toe daar twee ouwens na my toe gekom, en met my beklei, omdat ons nie die rooi vlag in Afrikaans gesing het nie. And they promptly burst into an Afrikaans version of Die Rooi Vlag. Of, you know, that's the type of thing that's just so fascinating. And I was very lucky in getting those things. And, you know, like, one of the big shocks to me was that Brahm wasn't a reader, or not the type of reader that I am. I had this thing, so how do you get into another person's head? You look for things that that you share. And I assumed that he would be a reader because he was an intellect. Hy was, soos wat ons in Afrikaans sê, 'n sidderende intellect. In die eerste meeting wat ek met jou gehad het, hy sê vir my, nee, Brahm, was nie 'n vreeslike reader nie, en hy het my hierdie story vertel van een van die boeke that came his way was Slaughterhouse-Five from Kurt Vonnegut, a boek wat my lewe verander het en my dalk 'n skrywer gemaak het, en en dis weer hierdie ding wat people adapt stances when they spoke of Brahm, like you was still healthy at the time, and he likes it, and he laughed, and he said, and Brahm came out and he was so cross and he hated Slaughterhouse-Five. He absolutely hated it. And that was for my, he with his die deeper touches. So as you know, I started with The Merchant of Venice, and that was the only bit I wrote before the play, before I met you, and then I thought, no, this man doesn't read. So what am I going to do? And then I found out from Ilse and from Hugh and from your book his love of music, and he's sort of like this, you know, I think that and that was a very, very important key to like sort of assume things about a person that you don't know. And I just have to say up front that I was absolutely intimidated. I mean, for those of you who've lived in Joburg is actually a very, very small place, right? So I kept very quiet about writing about this play because it seemed so daunting for many years. And when I started talking about it, everyone said, speak to Ilse, speak to you. And I didn't want to. I was, my eerste vrees was, ek het die respect vir die man en ek wou mense nie seer maak nie. En die tweede ding wat vir my as 'n kunstenaar baie belangrik was, ek wou nie haar geografie pleeg nie. Ek bedoel, in die politieke landskap van die Afrikaner is Brahm so verskriklike belangrike figuur. Ek wou hom nie ophemel nie. En dit was nogal moeilik geweest. En maar terselfde tyd, David and I had so much fun doing this play. The weirdest things happened. Like in Joburg, we did it in Tim's church. And David and they go to the same church. And everybody in that hall swam in Brahm's pool. You know, people, you know what? I swam in Brahm's pool. Another guy came, I spoke to somebody in Sweden tonight, and she said she swam in Brahm's pool. You know, so there was this whole network of anecdotal lichtstorikies and connections that absolutely made the whole process so joyous, you know. And there was this lady in Bloemfontein.
Everybody saying it swam in Brahm's pool, but Molly was carrying the scones and cool drinks and everything around.
There's actually some footage in that movie you made.
around the pool, right? Yeah. No, it's just, so that is how, this is a delayed response. That is how you sort of try and put a person together, you know, like sort of stealing these bits from what other people said. And I must say, I think that one of the nicest moments in the writing moment was you stepped out into your garden and I said, I'm writing this bit about Brahm being really cold and like walking towards the sun. And I'm really worried. Can I do that? And you said, go for it. Tell the story the way you have to tell it.
So let me tell you about Brahm and the sun. Brahm was looking after the seedlings and seed trays. We had a garden. And very fair-skinned, as you know. And Brahm in the sun burnt bright pink always, like a lobster. There he was, wearing an old fisherman's hat, a prison felt hat, which was utterly shapeless, sort of triangular down here. The hat must have been 20 years old. A lot of people had worn it beforehand. Wearing khaki shorts, which were too big for him, because in prison clothes you get are too big or too small. That's the only two sizes they have. And shoes and no socks and no laces, because he's gardening. And he's got the watering can and he's standing there and he's doing this. And the head of the prison, Captain Schneppel, who was a very laughable figure, actually, except that he had a lot of power. But he had a great big Kaiser Wilhelm moustache like this. And when he was angry, he would go, and it would flutter like a horse's mane. And he came up to me, watching Brahm doing this watering can trick. And he said to me, "Ach Gober, keiki o Stasi Meester." And he was referring to the 1930s. Poor white policy, blacks fired from the railways, white workers working on the railways, and garden competitions for station masters. And that's what this reminded Captain Schneppel of. Captain Schneppel himself had been a ganger on the roads in that period, so he knew the situation. And we could talk, it's funny, because if they had a chance to ride Brahm, they did. And yet when he said that, it was said with such affection. So I've coined a word, it's called affliction. You know.
Lovely.
But that was quite remarkable. But again, you see this appeal, Brahm being an Afrikaner and being loved as an outstanding Afrikaner and hated because he wouldn't fit the mold.
But you said you used Afrikaans to your advantage at times.
Well, I found if you asked for something in English, often the answer was no. But if you asked in Afrikaans, and all the prison warders said, "Ach my Goldberg, I praat ook traag Afrikaans," weet jy? Often the answer was yes. So if it helps with communication, and sincerely, when you read the literature and the poetry, it's a rich language. So, but it worked, except when Carl Niehaus came in, Afrikaner, and I'm explaining this to him, and damn it, I forgot about the microphone in the wall that we were next to. And the next day when I asked the commanding officer, the captain, something in Afrikaans, he answered me in English. And when I repeated in Afrikaans, he kept answering me in English. He never spoke Afrikaans to me again. He wasn't going to be manipulated. So he gave up his language for me.
Oh my goodness.
So sometimes in prison you have fun. You know, you can laugh about it. It was serious, but you can laugh.
Maar Harry, jy het ook baie geskryf oor die tipe van die monotoon daarvan om in die tronk te wees. En eintlik vir my 'n aangrypende stuk. Ons het nou nie voor die tyd ooreengekom nie, maar in die derde toneel waar die mate van herhaling en verveling aangeraak word. Hoe het jy besluit om dit in die drama in te werk?
Ek wou die story vertel op 'n manier wat wat ek net in die theater kon doen. Ek wou nie dokumentair maak nie, ek wou nie historiese werk skryf nie, ek wou theater maak. En dit was vir my a theatrical moment wat ek geskep het. En dit was ook vir my, ek wou die ding van waansin kry, wat ek weet met mense gebeur in solitary. Ek kan onthou my vriende in die 80's wat uit solitary uitgekom het, hulle het allemaal altyd gepraat van wat met hulle gebeur het. En dis een van die dinge wat gebeur het, mense het geloos. En dan die verband met Bram en Dennis en you en John Loretto en allemaal om hom, was vir my die connectie dat hy in sy alleenheid uitroep na hierdie mense toe. En dat hulle hom gehoor het, soos wat Dennis hom gehoor het in die laaste dag van Bram in die tronk. Ek dink dis, ek wou daai, dit was my moment van daai ding, daai malligheid, jy weet, daai ding van as hulle jou toesluit en hulle gaan weg. Dis skrikwekkend, ek weet nie, dit is vir my net te erg. En dit was terselfde tyd ook a celebration van hierdie koneksie van netwerk, wat daar tussen mense in sulke situasies ontstaan het.
Wel, vir my was dit een van die dele wat dit nie tot die geografie gemaak het nie, waar jy juist sy kwetsbaarheid gewys het.
Ja.
Die ander groot stap of gebeurtenis natuurlik, is deur die ander stuk muziek voorgestel,
ja.
En dit was die dood van sy vrou.
Ja. Ek denk dit is die belangrik, dit is vir my, voordat ek daarby uitkom, dit was die ding van, as mens gaan kyk na Bramse, die vrouwe in Bramse lewe, alhoewel Dennis sê, Molly wat rondloop met die ding, was dit vir my baie interessant, hoe belangrik vrouwens was, van oma Figart, tot by sy ma, tot by Tannie Tibby, tot by sy dochters. Vrouwens was geweldig belangrik in sy lewe, en dit was vir my een manier om dit te dink. En die vrouwe wat dan verskyn, of gehoor word in hierdie toneel, wat sê, don't worry Bram, the sun will rise again, wat terugverwys na sy speech, en dan terugslaan na die Hollandse zon sal weer reizen, wat vir my die hele thema was, want ek het die eerste keer in die story tegekom, in 76, jy weet, toe ons in Londen geblei het, en jy weet, dinge was wild. Ek kan onthou, ene hand het ons met Amerikaners gesit en praat in Londen, en hulle het vir my gesê, nou, wanneer gaan hierdie ding tot die einde kom? En ek het net gesê, ek weet nie. Jy weet, het was nie die ding van, die gevoel van, hierdie ding gaan nooit ophou nie. Hierso kom een burgeroorlog, hierso kom een helse ding. En dis vir my die ding wat Bram en sy, laat hy teruggryp na Paul Kreer toe, in sy speech, en dit aanhaal, en die soort van oomblik skep van hoop.
En trouwens, dis ook in die verhoog inkleding, was dit vir my een van die beste dramatiese punte, was hoe dat die kleur rooi, en dan die verskillende afbeeldings van, as ek die woord volksleiers kan gebruik is, miskien wil jy vir mense wat ook nie die opvoering gesien het nie, vertel daarvan.
Ja, ek dink dit was iets wat ons op die laaste oomblik besluit het. Dit was vir my, ek weet nie of ons reg so dan gekyk het nie, maar dit is weer eens net die dramatiese oomblik. Die oomblik van Bram en Percy en hulle opa, ou Bram. En dan die foto van David as Bram self. En dan reg aan die einde die rooi vlag wat hom bedek, terwyl die rooi vlag gesing word. So dit was vir my, die symboliek was seker daar, maar dis ook, jy weet, as het theater maak, denk jy, what's going to look great on stage? Maar ja, ek dink is dit van net, die rooi is belangrik, ja.
Mr. Goldberg, did you at any stage in this period of incarceration discuss the differences or perhaps the way that the theory of Marxism came to fruition, especially in the Soviet Union, which Bram Fischer visited in the 30s and which is sometimes criticized for its violence?
Did we discuss the way,
for instance,
the
under
aberrations
Stalin
in the Stalin era,
yes,
as against the theory?
Yes.
Brahm's attitude, as far as I remember, was they might be making mistakes in their situation. What we're looking for is a morally equitable way of living to overcome the disabilities of racism in our country. How do we achieve some kind of equality when there's such disparities of ownership of land, the means of production, mines, factories, etc.? And the theory requires that we have an equitable society, and therefore he held on to the theory. We had endless discussions about that and how we would apply it in South Africa. And just one maybe silly anecdote, but meaningful also, is that we would have no Wabenzi ministers. We would have no more than Volkswagen Beetles for ministers.
Might have lost some constituency.
But there's something I want to go back to. You're talking about prison. Brahm was removed from us and taken to his brother's home in Bloemfontein. And the assumption is that he'd been released. Brahm was a prisoner until his last breath. His brother's home was declared a prison, with prison officers visiting every day to make sure everything was, you can have it kosher or halal or in order, whichever way you want. And when he died, they followed the law to the letter. The body of the deceased remains the property of the prison authorities, normally buried in a prison graveyard. They did allow the cremation, as the family wished, but never released the ashes to the family. For me, the reason's clear. When Molly died, people turned out in their hundreds to her funeral to honor her, regardless of the laws about being banned and attending gatherings together. They simply ignored the law. If Brahm's ashes had been handed to the family and they'd been put somewhere, this would have become a political shrine. There's no doubt about it. And Mr. Kruger, the minister, who said that Steve Biko's death left him cold, was left very cold by Brahm Fischer's death, wasn't interested. And when asked for compassion, he said, Brahm Fischer signed a memorandum very harshly criticizing the government's prison policies. Well, there was a judicial commission of inquiry into the penal system. Brahm drafted something. He became very ill, was taken away. I worked on it together with Marius Schoen. Brahm brought back from hospital. I said we'd finished it. These are the changes we've made. Shall I sign for him per pro? And he said, no, sign his name, which is legal provided the person whose name you sign gives you permission. And so Jimmy Kruger, minister, said, Brahm Fischer to his dying day was hostile to the government and our policies. I will not show any leniency at all. Brahm removed from us, I asked my father at a visit to send a telegram of birthday greetings. How old would he have been, Ruth, in his last years? 67th birthday. And shortly after that birthday, he died. And a prison officer visits me to charge me with the prison offense of communicating with a prisoner without permission. Wanting to send a telegram. And I said, how? He said, well, we've got a recording of what you asked your father to send in the telegram. We've got the telegram, and so you were communicating. And I said, did you deliver the telegram? He said, no, it was illegal. And I said, what sort of a man are you? We've lived together for 9 years. I'm sending him a birthday greeting, and you stop the greeting when he's dying? I must tell you, I then gave him a lecture about the Nuremberg trial. Did I give him a lecture? What sort of a mean bastard are you? And I ended on a high note and stormed out of the room. It's a prison. The door was locked. It was a great performance. And he then said he was going to charge me with a prison offense. And I said, do. I want you to charge me. Imagine if this had got out. You go to court, because our lawyers would have brought to court, not an internal process. And the whole world knows, you know, they dropped the charge. Damn it.
Mr. Goldberg, before we get to questions, you wanted to say something about Brahm the Internationalist and invite people.
You know, I told you about not having newspapers. Again, a little piece of newspaper flew into the yard, somehow. And it was a story of a Soviet cruiser passing through the Straits of Malacca under the noses of the heads of the Commonwealth countries. And there was a frisson of fear of this great naval power, developing naval power. Within days, Brahm had worked out a strategy of how the Indian Ocean would become the turning point in the battle between East and West and would enable the eastern seaboard of Africa to be liberated. Well, you talked about Hugh Lewin. Hugh Lewin remembered this and took this message out, which eventually got passed on. Fred Carneson did it again later. But Brahm's sense of the world, of South Africa in the world, of our role in the world, never failed. It was there all the time. And so, you see, I have an exhibition on at the Castle of Good Hope, and Brahm would have loved the Good Hope part. It's an exhibition which I've called Decolonizing the Role of the Third World in World War II. The peoples of Africa, of Asia, of the Oceania, the Pacific, are written out of history. We know England fought Germany, Achtung Spitfire, and that sort of stuff. South Africa had some white soldiers up north. How many of us remember 80,000 Africans in the Native Military Corps, 23,000 peak in the Cape Coloured Corps, of their heroism, of the role they played, and 1 million African soldiers fighting for the British, 1 million fighting for the French and dying, let alone what happened in Asia and the Far East and the Pacific. And I believe, I saw this exhibition in Germany 6 years ago. The opening panel is Our Liberators and Their Black Soldiers. What a turnaround in history. It's taken me 6 years to get it to South Africa, to raise the funds, have it translated into English, to add a significant South African section. It's on at the Castle. I do want you to go. It's on till the 30th of June here. We have funding to take it to Pretoria. It's going to go to Joburg, another 2 years in South Africa after that, and I'm hoping throughout English-speaking Africa thereafter. Why? Because our constitution enjoins us to build a cohesive society, an inclusive society. An inclusive society requires that we acknowledge the role of all our people in our history. Not just South Africa, of Asia. Of the millions who died of starvation because the Western powers took the food to serve their armies. People died of hunger and starvation, besides being fighting soldiers, and the raw materials taken without proper compensation, let alone the lack of compensation when they were demobilized in comparison with white soldiers. Throughout the British Commonwealth, for example, and France, I believe to make some kind of restitution to people, not just in South Africa, throughout the world, for being written out of history for enabling us to defeat the Nazis and Japanese militarism so we could attempt to build a democracy. We need to acknowledge people and their role. Therefore, this exhibition. I want to tell you, I've known about all the facts all my life. And when I saw it put together in this really magnificently studied exhibition, I was bowled over by it, and I know you will be too. So, please, the Castle of Good Hope in the Military Museum. Let's have a look at our history. And our students are talking about decolonizing history. This is history written from the point of view of the colonial people, the Third World. It's worth going to find out. Shake up our ideas a little bit, just as Brahm would have done. Brahm, the internationalist, who immediately, hearing of a balance, a shift of power, of naval power, has a complete scheme worked out, because he's an internationalist. Taught me a lesson that I'll never forget. It's made me an internationalist as well. I owe him a lot. And Harry, for your play, I can't tell you how wonderful it is. I want it produced everywhere. I want it professionally filmed. I want it on YouTube. You won't make any money that way. But you've got a lesson to teach us in that play. Brahm's lesson about humanity, about decency, about justice. And so to be at Woordfeest and be able to say this, this is wonderful. Thank you.
Harry, het jy nog een stukje om vir ons te lees?
Yeah, I'd like to finish my contribution to from the English translation. And it was also an interesting process, changing it back into English, or changing it into English. For David and myself, we found these rhythms. Very early on in the process, I got obsessed with Brahms' Limp. And I asked Ilse, wat de bien het was sy manken, and she didn't remember. Left. And I think I tried to ask you as well, but
left hip.
And David was very unperturbed. He said, "I don't. I'm not speaking for Brahm Fischer. I'm speaking about Brahm Fischer." And dit is wat ons met hierdie play probeer doen het, om oor Brahm Fischer. Ons praat nie namens hom nie. Maar ek wil graag afsluit met die laaste monoloog in die stuk. Dit is aan die einde, as Brahm dood op die verhoog lê, dan hoor ons 'n stem wat die volgende sê. Brahm Fischer never danced out of the gates of the Pretoria local. By the time he left the prison on 25 March 1975, he was 66 years old and dying of cancer. His last months in prison were a hell of pain, suffering, bureaucratic brutality, official indifference, and the petty politics of the Minister of Justice, Jimmy Kruger, who refused to release him into the care of his daughters in Johannesburg. Brahm was taken to Bloemfontein. His brother Paul's home was declared a prison. Visitors and even mail were subject to prison regulations. Fischer was still a prisoner. Sometimes he would sit on the veranda with his daughter, his granddaughter and other family members. Mostly he was bedridden. On 8 May 1975, after 2 weeks in a coma, Brahm Fischer passed away. His funeral was small and attended only by his family and a few friends. The authorities confiscated his ashes immediately. More than a year later, without the knowledge of his family, his remains were strewn in an unknown place in Bloemfontein.
So eindig die drama, en ek is seker dat u vrae moet hê. Dis nie elke dag dat 'n mens met sulke mense op die verhoog sit nie. Meneer Goldberg en Harry Kalmer hierso. Is daar enige iemand met 'n vraag? In daai geval dan sê ek vir u baie baie dankie. Baie dankie dat u uitgekom het. Thank you so much, Mr. Goldberg, for sharing with us. Deeply appreciated. Harry, baie dankie vir wat jy geskryf het. Baie dankie vir wat het verteenwoordig. Baie dankie vir al die hart wat jy daar ingesit het. Dankie, dames en here.
Dankie.